Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Hey, thanks for joining us here on the program. You do know, if you've listened to this program for any length of time, we come your way on Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., streaming live at richarddugan.com, as well as on the radio show's pages where the podcast can be found, as well as SoundCloud and iTunes. We also are looking for any ideas you might have for guests for our program. Always excited about that, because we'd like to know where you're coming from. And hopefully it'll be taking us to a new place, a better place for all here on the program. We're also looking for support for the radio broadcast. If you are someone who is able to do that, we're greatly appreciative. We have a PayPal account that you can contribute to and through a link that's on the homepage, as well as on the missions page. If you'd like to read a little bit more about what we're all about, that's where you'll find that information. So very excited about that. And also at Patreon, I believe that's how it's pronounced, P-A-R-T-E-O-N. Maybe it's just patron.com, where we have a special offer. If you're interested, please avail yourselves of the link that is on the homepage of richarddugan.com. We are going to change the world, blast it. I don't care what you say, we're going to do it. We're going to turn it into a square, maybe a rectangle, octagonal, I don't know. We're going to change the world for better. We've been talking about it for decades. We've been talking about it for, well, as long as I've been doing interviewing, wanting to make this a better world for all of us. And we have a couple of gentlemen on the line here, father and son team, they are, the father is the author of the book primarily, Julian H. Hyman, and he has written a book called You Can Save Our World. He's on the phone with his son, Steve. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us on the program. I'm excited about the prospects for the future, knowing that I've got this book in my hand.
Well, thank you for having us, Richard.
Julian, you are in your 90s, is that correct?
I am 98 years old.
98, and you have seen a hell of a lot on this planet, and it's been through a lot, if you want to put it that way as well. And yet, from this particular work, even at the age of 98, you're still optimistic, aren't you?
Very much so.
Why?
Because I think the world's beginning to appreciate that some things have been being done incorrectly, and we to survive, we've got to change.
Well, you know, we've been hearing that especially from our political candidates for decades. You know, we're gonna change things. We're gonna make things better. And from my observations, and you know better than I because you've seen a lot more of it than I. But I can all I have to do is go back. I'm 58, and I've got probably an observational period of maybe 40 years. Where I haven't seen any improvement whatsoever for the common man, because every time we elect a new set of officials, they're from the other side and they do things their way. Then the next cycle comes around and the people from the other side are elected because we're dissatisfied with what the first group did. They come along and they undo everything from the last group. Then the next cycle comes and it's rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat, rinse and repeat. And we don't seem to be getting anywhere. What are some of the signs that you are seeing, Julian, that lead you to believe that, yeah, maybe we're finally getting the message?
Some of the signs is that the countries are starting to talk to each other more. They disagree, but there's more discussion between the countries than there had been. My idea is to eliminate countries as such and combine the whole world as one government and eliminate all armies except the master army of the central government.
Okay, well, who would the master government be? That's the question, because that's going to be a concern of a lot of folks.
What we would do is set up a organization that would set up a whole new constitution, and all countries presently would join it as we have states in the United States and a central government. All countries would be the states and combine as a central new central government.
maybe in a fashion sort of what the EU was sort of trying to do?
In a fashion, yes. But the EU has a lot of weaknesses and a great deal of politics. We would eliminate that thing. It would be where we could easily communicate with everybody on the new systems of communication over the internet and get to know that we are all one people. We're the same. We all want happiness for our families.
That's interesting you use that word, because I often think in conversations on this program about the Constitution of the United States. And of course, in the preamble, it talks about how we have these inalienable rights, and of them, and there are more than just these three, you have life. All right, we get life. If you're breathing and you're upright, so to speak, you have life. Liberty, you know, that's a little more tenuous depending upon where you live. But it doesn't give you the third one. You can pursue it, but I don't know if we'll ever get it. And it's you can pursue happiness. You believe that that you know, using that word, that this is attainable. And I'm curious as to when or how long you think this will take before we can arrive at this state. I'm just curious about that.
Well, I'm basing this upon my own personal experiences. I was in the import business and took a trip around the world every year for a month and a half, going to third world countries and importing from them. In my process, I met people of every ilk. And I found out that we're all interested in the same thing. That is, we want to get the best of life we can, which is short, for ourselves and our families. And if we work together, I was frequently asked, what do I have to do to move to the United States? Can you help me?
Well, you know, there's that one phrase I have heard time and time again, especially from immigrants coming to this country, especially through Ellis Island, the turn of the 20th century, and that was that this is the land of opportunity. But it seems as though that phrase somehow missed those of us who were born here. I don't know, because we seem to complain an awful lot, at least, I don't know, maybe our governments do, officials, complain an awful lot about, like this last election that we had, what I kept hearing was that, you know, we're the victims of some outside force like the other countries, and that we've got to take control and so on and so forth. And I thought, wait a minute, I thought we were through with victimhood back in the 80s and early 90s. We went through that whole self-help process. And yet here we are, 2016, that campaign, and I'm hearing the same thing again. We're a victim. And what are your thoughts about that?
Well, my thoughts are that we have to communicate with the people in other countries. We complain about what we are doing here, but when you find out what other countries have to live with, you can see that here we have it very good. You know, you hear about the returning to this country from other countries and mentally kissing the ground. Well, you can make that for all the countries in the world if you will work together as one person, one people, and understand what other countries and the people in it are suffering under, and how good we have it. And the idea is, how can we carry over some of our good things so they also could accept them?
Richard, I think basically, too, what you're getting at is, you know, you're right. I mean, the initial, you know, our parents, basically, and other relatives who come over from Ellis Island, I think as generations trickle through, we tend to take our liberties for granted. And it's so easy just to complain. And I keep telling people, you know, if you don't take part of the process, you have no reason to complain. You know, I started taking these trips with my father. My dad's traveled around the world probably over 40 times in a 36-year period. And as he's mentioned, he had a chance to interact with people of different denominations, different religions, different, basically, men, women. So he's gotten to interact and really see what life is like. And during my travels around the world, you know, if from third world countries, you realize, I mean, when I got back to the United States, I was like, my whole mentality changed. And if you take the good things that every country has to offer, because the United States is great, and we can learn from other countries too, like maybe take the health care from Canada, you take what Israel's doing with their military, you look at what China is doing to some extent with what they have with solar energy. 25% of electricity comes from solar power in China. So a lot of countries, you know, have a lot to offer the good ideas, and we can create one really strong and hopefully happy unit for everyone.
Well, you know, I can't disagree with you. And my real problem that I've observed, and again, I've only been here for, like I said, 58 years, and only really observing for maybe the last 40, maybe 45, is that America has this attitude that they're going to do it their way. I don't care how Canada did it. I don't care how China did it. I don't care how Europe did it or any other country. We're going to find our own way, in spite of the fact that these other countries have had such great success with, you know, whatever it is that, you know, we're thinking about doing. And it doesn't seem like this country, at least at large, and maybe I'm wrong. You guys have done the traveling, you, Julian, and you, Steve, you've done the traveling. And so you would know better than I, but it just seems like, no, we're going to find our own way. I don't care if they were successful at it. We're going to reinvent the wheel. Do you see that much?
That's only the opinion of a certain group. That is not the total opinion of everybody in you know, America.
Okay. Well,
I mean, a lot of you're right. A lot of people in this country do think that way. But there's a strong also part of the population that does not. And unfortunately, you're right. The masses, the leadership might be thinking that way. But when you get into the grassroots, you know, they're starting to understand. And as far as, you know, it's – and as you said, yes, what's going to make the difference? We have to make the difference. You and I, everyone, it's you. You know, there are a lot of great people doing a lot of things on major levels. You hear about Bill and Melinda Gates, what they're doing about polio. You hear about a lot of great things. But individually, you know, we're all doing our own part. We just need to play a larger part and just a little bit more, because it's the youth that's going to be the leaders of tomorrow. And we need to make sure that they have a good foundation in order to do this.
But I also would say, too, that there is the concern that the current leaders, whether it be 2018 or 2008 or 1998 or 2028 for that matter, that the current administration that happens to be in power in those respective periods of time, what have you, are messing it up for the rest of us. They're not really considering everybody. They're more concerned with maybe at one administration, they're more concerned with military buildup, and another administration is more concerned with, you know, business and making sure that all of our treaties are more in our favor than the others, and so forth and so on. And, you know, I don't know. I've had this, maybe it's Pollyanna on my part, but I had this one dream that, let's just say, I was king for a day. And this is subject to change. This is not something that I say we're going to do this and, you know, forget about anything else. Pull all our troops home and put them to work rebuilding our infrastructure. They're already being paid, so it's not like it's going to be a burden on the economic system. To help to rebuild the infrastructure that has been laid waste for so many decades. Of course, then it will be those who will argue, well, yeah, how are you going to what happens if there are conflicts around the world? So, hey, if they want our help, they're going to have to petition for our help, and, you know, we'll do what we can.
If you have the countries eliminate their armies, they can't get things done by we'll do it our way or else we'll conquer you.
Right.
You will have world courts, and if any country has any problem with another country, it must go to a court decision.
Yeah.
And Richard, there's a lot of validity in what you're saying. You're right. As each political office, as each specific, whether it's Republicans or Democrats, take office, they're implementing their own policies, and we are being ping-ponged from one side to the other. And it's hard, really, to get a lot of things, you know, structurally done. But I understand what you're saying, and yet there's a lot, you know, the point is well made. I mean, you know, we do need one strong military. Unfortunately, we spend twice, if not three times as much as every other country in the world, protect our democracy. That's, we're talking trillions of dollars. And yes, that money could be better spent, but we do need to protect our liberties. But also, you're right, we need to worry about the infrastructure. And if you look what Israel is doing, you know, they're requiring basically every high school graduate to give 2 years back to the military. Now, I agree, you know, when you think about it, that can do two things. It's twofold. It can help build discipline, because a lot of our children today, unfortunately, are lacking that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think that if we implemented something like this, it could be really a positive influence in this country.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, it's the one, I'm going to call it social structure, the military, is the one social structure that binds people together. Now, preferably not having to do it in combat, but certainly that's the real crucible, if you will. But that's the structure. And in a military society, there is no democracy. You can't have a democracy in a military society. And again, talking about the military specifically, because if everybody said, no, I don't want to do that, and then let's vote on it, you know, you'd be annihilated before, you know, you got off the ground, so to speak. So, you know, there are some aspects to all of this that we do have to take a look at and really look at very carefully before we jump. But again, I don't have all the answers. I'm looking just like everybody else. Steve, I'm curious,
yeah.
Steve, about, you know, you've traveled with your dad, and I want to talk to Julian here in a minute too, but you've traveled with your dad around the world. And I often hear from people who have never set foot on foreign soil, not even Mexico or Canada. This is the greatest country in the world. And my first question to them is, have you lived anywhere else? Now, you guys have lived, even if it's for short times, in other parts of the world. Is that a statement that you can emphatically make?
Honestly, Richard, you know, I've been to some countries, and granted, I had the luxury of visiting Hong Kong before it was taken over by China. And Hong Kong, it blew me away. It was so clean. It was so metropolitan. It reminded me of New York, but so much cleaner. I was like awestruck. I never knew countries like this around the world existed. And you know what really was dumbfounded me? The people on the streets, the panhandlers, they're unionized. At least in the 80s, they were unionized. They each had to get a license, and they were all assigned a corner. It was unbelievable.
Wow.
This is craziness. And in India, I mean, India is a lot more metropolitan now than it was in the 80s. But, I mean, imagine going down dirt roads and riding in cabs, and the cab drivers were pushing off the other cabs so they wouldn't get in accidents, going in like 25, 30 miles an hour down. It was craziness. I thought I was in a Western. And I came back to the United States, and I tell my friends, they're like, that's unbelievable. You know, I mean, because I was in my 20s, and, you know, I was very fortunate, and a lot of my friends didn't have the luxury of having that opportunity at that age. And it was just craziness. So to answer your question, you know, at that point, Hong Kong was just amazing to me. It opened my eyes to, wow. But that's what education and life and new life experiences do to people. Yeah.
Julian, I want to ask you the same question. You've traveled around the world. You've seen it all, so to speak. And you've experienced different lifestyles. Do you answer the question? How do you answer that question?
Well, my book gives a method that if we have a club in each country and the clubs are educational, and you use them to communicate with people in other countries, and you, any problem that you have, you say, we've got this problem, and what do you do in your country to solve this problem? I think we would gain a lot that we don't do today. Today we're interested only me, what's in it for me, and so forth.
Yeah, I've only been to two other countries. I flew through one other country, England, to get to Ireland, and I spent 2 weeks. I had two trips of 2 weeks each, and I have to tell you that the second trip there felt like we were just picking up where we left off, and so I was like, we're spending a month in Ireland. How nice. And then the only other country I was in, both on the western and eastern shores, was Mexico. I was on a little cruise, so I never really experienced you know, the economy and really the people and all this kind of stuff, because you get off the boat, you tool around, and then you come back on the boat and go down the coast. And then, of course, the Tulum ruins, the Mayan ruins on the peninsula, the Yucatan Peninsula. So I don't have a lot of experience living elsewhere. I just find it interesting that people will make these comments based upon something they haven't experienced. And I have to tell you, it's not, to me, it's not enough to see it on TV or in a documentary. You actually do really need to go there and experience that. And that's probably one of the downfalls, if you will, of our educational system, is that we really don't teach about the other parts of the world. And I'm curious, Julian, because this is your work, You Can Save Our World. By the way, that U is spelled U. You can save our world.
The letter U.
That's the letter U. Have you been accused of thinking about some kind of a utopian society that just is going to be perfect and all of this kind of stuff? How do you address that kind of a criticism?
I do not tell anybody that this is going to be paradise. It's going to be a major improvement. We form of upgrading our civilization. Killing people is not a civilized thing to do, in my way of thinking.
Well, I'm with you there.
We eliminate that.
Yeah, I'm with you there. That doesn't seem too civilized.
No, so that's where we start at. When a child is born any place in the world, they are all exactly the same the first day of birth. As they get involved in their local cultures, they start changing. But by educating them and letting them communicate with each other and so forth, we can have a different attitude than we have now.
Are either of you familiar with the gentleman? He's since passed, but his name is Jacques Fresco of the Venus Project?
No.
Well, he also is... one who had a dream and a vision for a future civilization. And I interviewed him twice when he was 94 and then 99. And I remember asking him at the end of one of the first interview, so do you think this is going to happen in our lifetime? To which he responded, well, it most likely isn't going to happen in my lifetime, and it probably won't in yours. And I said, well, why not? I'm excited. I think this is great. And he said, basically, and I want you guys to respond to this in light of You Can Save Our World, the book and these concepts. He said that until the populace's consciousness is raised above the place where it is, it'll never happen. I guess quoting Einstein, who said you cannot solve a problem with the same attitude or mentality or thinking that created the problem.
And following up on Albert Einstein, after the Second World War, basically, he approached the United Nations, and he wrote an open letter to them, stating that, I've seen it, I've worked on the atomic bomb, and I know this is not the right direction to go. He said, there'll be a Third World War. And he said, after the Third World War, the Fourth World War will be fought with sticks and stones, meaning that the world will annihilate itself. So he wrote an open letter to the United Nations saying that, proposing that there should be a one-world government in order for civilization to survive.
But you know the religious communities are going to be up in arms over a one-world government. That's bringing in the all these prophecies and so forth.
My idea is that this movement that I propose will not have anything to do with religions or with politics. It's a matter of people's education and how they start feeling about things that'll make the difference.
Right. The book is not to eliminate culture. The book is not to eliminate people's religion and heritage, because the religion and heritage, people should take a lot of pride in that. And the book basically states, we want that to continue. What we're proposing is maybe a dual world language. Obviously, there'll be one single world language, and then there'll be a secondary language of that's common to the people. Mm-hmm. And as well as religion, we're not saying there should be, everyone should be able to practice any religion they want to. It's their right.
They don't
deserve to
interfere with other somebody else.
Well, yeah,
it's strictly kept to themselves.
Well, that could take some doing and convincing, because there are a lot of people who are very hell bent on their philosophy, and they want everybody to follow their philosophy or die. I mean, you have the Spanish Inquisition, you know, among other things.
That's correct. And it all comes down, Rich, one of the main points in the book basically focuses also is on the population. Do you know what the population was in 1927? It was 2 billion people.
Yep.
And less than 100 years later, we're over 7.6.
That's right,
7.6. Cannot continue.
Yeah.
You know, we need to come up like with a business plan. The world needs a business plan in order to survive. Human race will not survive without a business plan moving forward, where intellectually we say, hey, people, what do we need to continue everyone's happiness? Let's all get on the same page. You know, let's and we're at a day and an age where it can happen. I mean, the internet, where people now are connecting faster and faster. It seems like this is the perfect opportunity to do it. My father's book, You Can Save Our World, it's not an end-all be-all. It's really it's a guide of talking points to start this and stimulate conversation on what we need to do it, because we can do it. We need to be positive, we need to work together, and we can solve problems a lot better that way.
You know, the other thing too that I find fascinating, and I'm reading here in your book, having to do in this one particular section called Your Choice, which we talk about all the time. It's about choices and knowledge of those choices to help make one's dreams come true. But if you don't have the education to foster those new choices, you don't have any choices. And I use this example of people who are unfortunately, sometimes for generations, they're on the public dole. They're part of the entitlement programs because that's all they know. They don't know anything more because they can't get a better education, because they can't afford it for whatever other reasons, and because that's where they're kept. And so they don't know that it's possible to do other things yet. And I was looking at one in particular here where it says that in today's world, our geographic areas are exclusive to certain ethnic backgrounds or religions, whereas the possibility under the United World, the Constitution would prohibit arbitrary segregation for any reason that can be tied to color, sex, religion, and so on. One of the arguments that I have, for example, and I live in Santa Barbara, which is supposedly considered to be a very affluent area, you know, one of the great places on the planet, you know, we have the Riviera and so on and so forth. And there are some people who do not want the people who work here to live here. And they say, if you can't afford to live in Santa Barbara, then you should not live here. You should live somewhere else. And so they must commute 20, 30 minutes from, say, Ventura or maybe Buellton or Santa Maria or so forth. In other words, cities that are a good 20, 30, 40, 50 miles, 50 minutes away. And I have a real problem with that. It's like, I want to be able to live close to where I work, and I can get rid of my car, I can take public transit, I can walk, I can bicycle and really enjoy myself. If I want to go on a vacation and travel, I take the train, plane, I'll rent a car, those kinds of things. What are your, then let's kind of talk a little bit about this in terms of, I mean, people are, you know, up in arms over a lot of folks who want to talk about, for example, the redistribution of wealth. My perspective, and I could be wrong, observation, folks, this is my observation. Capitalism and free enterprise is the redistribution of wealth, especially when you look at marketing and advertising.
My idea is that militarism costs a fortune of money. When you consider of all the things that have to be covered by it. Now, if you can just eliminate militarism and use that money for education, there'll be more education and a higher education for that you said is now not available.
Mm-hmm. Steve?
And also, I suggest that we create a worldwide... a club And had the local people join the club, and at the club meetings, one of the features would be they would get in touch with a club in another country and the people of it, and talk between each other and find out how much we are alike and how we can help each other.
Richard, we don't want to eliminate capitalism, because I agree, that basically. That has done so much for this, at least this country, and it's people thrive. It basically, it's the competitiveness, and we probably wouldn't have a lot of things that we have if it wasn't for capitalism. But what we do, I don't know if you agree with this or not, but the distribution of wealth definitely, because there is too much of a divide, and you see it, and it's getting worse each day. With that being said, I mean, you look at what capitalism is doing, and also. And you can combine that with the problem with the population, because look what, don't look now, but robotics. I mean, robotics are going to play a major role, in the blue collar, and a lot of the jobs are going to be eliminated, and people aren't really, maybe it's the vision to understand this. It's going to take away, instead of three shifts, it's going to be a 24-hour shift. Yeah. People aren't going to be, there's going to be no unions, because you won't need health insurance. So a lot of jobs are going to disappear. So I think people really need to evaluate long-term. Yes, capitalism is great, but you got to remember, you've got to keep everybody on the same page.
Yeah.
You can't have a major distribution of wealth so far above, and then you're eliminating the middle class. And
yeah.
Not only are you eliminating the middle class, but the upper echelon is going to be so high above, the people down below aren't even going to be able to see it.
Yeah.
We all need to get together and come up with a plan.
Jacques Fresco, one of the pillars of his civilization was that this would be a resource-based economy. And that means that the resources belong to all the people. Now, you'd still have to have distribution, but the distributors would not own it. They wouldn't control it. They would distribute it, which seems to be the biggest problem when it comes to feeding the world's hungry, is it's not that there isn't enough food. It's that it's not getting to them. And I use this analogy in regards to Jacques' example of a resource-based economy. Let's just say that flash drives are still in vogue when we get to that space. There's going to be a shop that's going to be open with giant bins of different size flash drives. And I walk in, all I have to do is pick one up and walk out the door, and I can go use it and so forth. And a guy walks up to me with a gun and says, I want your flash drive. Well, he can't steal it from me because I can give it to him and go get another one, which I, of course, tell him as well. Do you know that there's a big bin just two doors down which you can get all that you want and find and so forth? But if you want mine, here, because I'm just going to go get another one. So there's been no crime because I'm willingly giving it to him. And, not because he's threatening me, but because I know there's more that I can get. And this is one of the things that is kind of interesting to me, especially when it comes to fuel, for example, gas. It's the only commodity that I'm aware of on the planet that fluctuates in price almost on a daily basis. No other price of any other commodity on the planet fluctuates like the price of gas.
But the price of gas is human manipulated in many times.
I agree. But, when was the last time you went to buy a loaf of bread on Tuesday and then Wednesday it was higher or lower than it was on Tuesday? It doesn't happen like that. Then I sometimes think when prices were approaching $5 a gallon here in California a few years back, I was thinking, would the guys who are running the corporations, would they make their mothers pay $5 a gallon? I don't think so. And yet they make us do that, and they'll give us all kinds of reasons. And maybe there's another aspect of it, too. You know, we were talking about capitalism, Steve, and there was one factor that really hasn't been taken into consideration when capitalism was established, and again, not having been educated in the history of capitalism, I don't know when it began. But the one factor that was never calculated into the equation was the factor of greed. That seems to be the biggest problem we've got with capitalism and free enterprise. Maybe the system as a principle is great. But in practice, this is why we have disparate separation in incomes.
You talk about greed. Greed is an emotion, and it's the human emotion that is our biggest problem. If we could operate without emotion and use common sense only, we would have a much happier lives.
Yeah, but is there a shop that sells that? Because
there is. And you're going to laugh, but I'm going to tell you something.
Please.
Steve mentioned robots.
Mm-hmm.
Robots do not have emotions.
True.
All right. And robots can be taught intelligence. Artificial intelligence in robots is a growing science.
Yes.
I can visualize the day when governments will be run by robots, not humans, because they will have no emotion.
And they're going to do what's best for the humans, hopefully.
Yes, that would be it, exactly.
Interesting.
And Richard, the bottom line is basically, rich, poor, indifferent. It's the human life, this life cycle and the life expectancy. When I was growing up, it was maybe in the 60s. Now it's like in the 80s. And whether that's a problem or not, people are living too long. The bottom line is, though, we all want to be happy.
Yes.
Regardless of how much money we have, unless we're healthy, we're not happy.
You got it.
So we need to all work together. Happiness, is a short-term thing. So the bottom line, and even the book, it states this. What do we have to do? What do we all have to do to work together to make sure that our quality of life is a lot better? That is the emphasis. It's whether you listen to the news each day, and they emphasize the bad things as opposed to the good things. But a lot of people are doing some great things out there.
Mm-hmm.
What we all need to do is really concentrate on what we can do to make our children, to help our children, not make to help them live a happier existence. And it can be done.
Yeah.
It definitely can be done.
I've heard this argument over the years in my career in broadcasting. When the proposal was made, hey, let's just have a half hour good news half hour. And of course, the argument comes back, it'll never sell, because in the news business, if it bleeds, it leads. And there's not much bleeding in good news. And yet I am very heartened, I guess, as opposed to being heartened by some of the network newscasts. At least they're putting, even though it's at the end, they're putting some really good human interest, good news, people doing good things stories into the broadcast. And I applaud them for that. It's a start.
No, you're absolutely right. It's basically,
violence
basically sells.
Yeah.
And, advertising, you've got to, it's a business.
Yeah.
It's a business. And so if people understand this, they say, look, okay, they're doing this because, but people also have the right to boycott. They can say, look. And I think that's where we can save the world. It's you. Each individual, and as we talked about earlier, each individual has the right to vote, has the right to take control of their lives.
Yeah.
But they just have to get involved. If you leave it to the other guy, it's not going to get done. If you think they're going to do it, then it's not going to. It's we. You, we all need to do our little part, and we need to step up.
Yeah.
And we can all make a difference.
You
but it's not going to happen because the other guy's not going to do it.
You're right. You Can Save the World. That is the title of the book. We are talking with father and son, Julian H. and Steve Hyman, and we are going to continue talking with them here on Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Please stay with us.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
Welcome back. I'm Richard Dugan along with Steve and Julian, and we're talking about saving our world. You can, I can, we can, she, they, everybody's involved, everybody's included. I've often used the analogy, gentlemen, that with this program, we're here to find new paradigms for a new world. We're looking for those new ways of living because the old ways, they don't work. Just look around you. You don't have to go very far and you notice they're not working. And I say, we have a lifeboat. We have a lifeboat and it will hold 7.6 billion people if that's where we're at right now. However, the one condition to get on is that you have to be willing to let go of the old ways of doing things. And that doesn't mean that we abandon every single old way. It means that we're not going to be doing business as usual because look at where it's gotten us. We have to take the bits and pieces that work, that really work, and then construct them into something new. You talked, Julian, about a new world constitution. Have you been working on anything like that, or do you have any concepts, precepts, articles of confederation, if you will, that you've theorized, or even you, Steve, if the two of you have been working together as maybe the founding fathers as a sort.
What we need to establish is think tanks of some of the greatest brains of the human race now alive, and turn them on to solving some of these problems and forming this new government. We cannot depend upon the United Nations. It's too political. It will not work.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The book states that there should be a foundation. By the name of SO, or whatever anyone wants to call it, SO standing for Society of One World, whereas my dad had mentioned, yes, some of the brightest minds of the world would come together and basically put this idea to paper and then conceptualize it.
I mean, and it seems to me a daunting task, especially considering, would you start from scratch, or would you utilize, sort of my analogy earlier, bits and pieces of other constitutions around the world, including the U.S. Constitution, to start to formulate, maybe use those as seeds?
That would be open for discussion, debate. I mean, on a personal level, and as the book states, the book is not basically, it's just talking points. It's a guide. From a personal level, Richard, yes, I agree that every country has a lot of good ideas to add to this one world. So, I mean, personally, I would take some of the better ideas from as many countries as I could. Some countries might have a lot of them, some countries might have none, but yes.
Hmm. When did this idea start to germinate for you, Julian?
I started to germinate about 10 years ago. In my travels, I would make some notes of unusual things and ideas. I traveled mostly by myself, so there was some very lonesome periods that I would use that to keep myself occupied. Some years later, I was up at night, and we were having a problem with our daughter who has a serious illness. And I was thinking, what can I do to help things? And I decided I got enough material here to write a book. And I started on writing a book. And then after a while, I said, well, I'm not going to get anywhere further on this, because as some of the things that you explained do exist, and they would prevent it from happening. But then it began to appear for me that there's a higher power in this world than ourselves that's directing this world. And I seriously believe that. And when I returned to doing the book, my daughter's health improved somewhat. And I feel that I am being guided and promoted to push these ideas through to happen.
I'm curious as to your I'll call it spiritual background. What philosophy did you come up in from your parents and your family and your community when you were first growing up in the early part of the 20th century?
Well, I find that in this world there's we people and me people. Some people say, well, what's in it for me? If it's not interesting or good for me, I'm not interested. There's other people saying, every time I see somebody suffer, I suffer. And I was brought up in that kind of a family.
And Steve, I would take it that you kind of took it from there in the next generation?
Well, I tell you, it's, and I'll touch a lot of points with you. My dad was writing this book, basically. It's like most people, you know, it's like, you know, it's so easy to leave it up to the other person to do something, you know, because, I mean, it's hard enough to decide what you want to eat for dinner, you know, or where you, what you're going to do tomorrow than it is to think about life for your children in the future. So when I used to go over to my parents' house, you know, for Thanksgiving and some of the holidays, you know, my dad would say, Steve, look what I've done. You know, come here, listen, you know, read a couple chapters. And I'm like, Dad, that's great, Dad. You know, I would humor him and say, yeah, okay, that's you know, it kept him out of trouble, I'm thinking. And, wow, keep it up. Yeah, and then I'd say, hey, Ma, what's for dessert? But in reality, I have an adopted daughter from Russia. And that's a story in and of itself. But, you know, today you can't even adopt children in Russia because of political and economic sanctions. Mm. But as she started getting older, you know, it started to realize what dawned me, what, you know, what's in it for her? What's her life going to be like? So that's when I started to really bear down on this. And I started to get involved probably about a year ago. And you said, Dad, you know what? You know, you got something here. You know, we all need to play a part. I mean, we all, you know, I mean, I've been doing certain things, you know, basically, you know, sure, donating to charity, picking up trash, you know, starting to curb pollution on the streets any way I could. But we need to spread the word. I hope that answers your question.
Yes, it does. I'm curious, too, as to, I mean, obviously your dad's already said he's very optimistic about the future. How about you? Are you just as optimistic or maybe more so? And what are the signs for you that that spur that that optimism?
Well, you know, I'm definitely very optimistic. I think basically, you know, whether it's the internet, I think basically, you know, people, and you see it, people are curious and people want it. You know, they do believe. There's a lot of, you know, I mean, yes, there's a lot of factions pulling in a lot of directions, but that means they're all willing to get involved. And I think it's important because anyone who wants to complain, you know, I tell people when it comes to political situations, unless you take part in the process, you have no reason to complain about what you're dealing with. Whether it's Republican, Democrat, makes no difference. You know, things aren't going to get done. Problems do not get solved by people who complain. And I see more people stepping up to the plate and getting involved.
However, you also have to acknowledge, too, that there have been processes that have been in play for a number of years. And, you know, case in point, the last place I ever want to I doubt very seriously I'm 58 if I'm ever going to get a law degree. But the last place I ever want to find myself is in front of a Senate confirmation hearing. And that scares the bejeebers out of a lot of people saying, oh, my God, no way. I would never put myself and my family through that. You know, that's the kind of thing that troubles people about the present system that we're in, that there is so much incivility or uncivility. I'm not sure which is the right word here. Do you see us somehow surviving and getting past that to getting back to civil discourse to try to solve, again, some of the problems that we have?
That's going to be a tough nut to crack, you know, basically. And whether they're I could talk hours on this subject. But, yes, we're gonna have to. Because, you know, and I was thinking about this and talking about this morning with some people. People in life go through cycles and they change. And the question is, you know, do you take it on face value, or do you try to accept them on where they were, you know, years ago? I mean, every second is so different. It's a learning experience. You know, all of our lives can change, and people need to understand this from second to second. Some people say day to day. I mean, you cross over the street and get hit by a bus, and you know, I mean, that second is going to change your life forever. So, you know, people really have to draw the line, you know, on what the value is and what's the most important thing in making these decisions. When it comes to the electoral process, I mean, you know, I vote the issue, not the candidate. Mm-hmm. And people in their own minds, they're going to have to take part of the process and vote or do what's best in their heart and move on and let things go.
Well, I know that there are those I've talked with who actually say that, and they complain, and they don't participate in the process, and they say, I would stop complaining if they would stop taking my money, because I am paying their salaries with my tax dollars. So if they would allow me to stop paying their salaries with my tax dollars, I'd go in the corner and be quiet. That's kind of their perspective, because they've kind of, they're fed up.
There's some validity. There's a lot of validity to that.
It's the matter of education. You have to educate people so that you've got to use what you have to help the other person, and it's without that, the whole thing will fall apart.
I want to touch upon an area that I understand where you're coming from this, but I want to expand on this a little bit. I understand that we do not want to tell people how to believe. Whatever their philosophy is, their philosophy. But what about the spiritual underpinnings, which, again, that's a big, broad word to use. I understand that. But, I mean, there are a lot of folks that we have on this program who come from different philosophies. I mean, I've had Christians, I've had Jews, I've had rabbis, great conversations with rabbis. I've had atheists and Christian Science and Scientology and Baha'i and on and on and on, and speaking very, very well of their particular philosophy. But they all have this deep, abiding spirituality and respect for other people. And I'm curious as to how we can, you talk about education on the one level for some of these issues, but how do you teach that kind of connectedness and that we are important to one another and for one another?
And as you say, as it should be, you know, the world is a melting pot, and you're right. And you look at, as my dad said, and as the book also mentions, you know, we're a product of our environment. I mean, basically, whether you're born Jewish or with Catholic or you're Muslim, I mean, you know, it's basically, you know, that is, you assimilate into your environment. So, I mean, it's basically, if you take people out of their environment, you know, you need to change the environment. You need to work with people and say, you know what? I'm here to help you. I'm not here to destroy you. You know, I'm here to help you live. Religion is good. Culture is good. So but what we needed to tell people and make them understand is the underlying substance or factor in all this is basically people are people, regardless of your color, regardless of your religion, regardless of your age. You know, we're here to try to survive. And one of the most common denominators is we all deal with problems. I don't care how much money you have, how much money you don't have, everyone deals with problems. That's what life is about, dealing with problems and moving on and hopefully experience a little bit of happiness or a lot of happiness and then dealing with the next issue that comes your way.
I agree with Steve 100%.
Okay.
The way he put it.
Well, that's great. And I applaud you, both of you, for in some circles, for sticking your neck out, because this is not an easy subject for people to talk about. But I talk about it all the time because Julian, I'm only 58. My dad's 87, and I'm frustrated. I have had enough of this quibbling back and forth politically and religiously, educationally, because it's not getting us anywhere. What is the definition of insanity? Doing the same thing over and over again, expecting different results.
Right?
Yeah. It's not going to happen.
Yeah, that's great.
It's not going to happen. So we have to raise our consciousness to a level that we can solve the old problems with new solutions. In 2008 and 2009, when we had that economic downturn, as I will call it, and I heard this phrase, "We've never been in this situation before as a country. This is new territory for us." And what did they do? They used old solutions for a problem that they claimed we'd never been in before. And we're headed in the same direction all over again. And it just amazes me that people let them get away with it. It's like, no, you can't do that. You know, this is not the horse and buggy days anymore. You can't keep feeding the horses, expecting that they're going to survive on the super highways of 405 in California. It's not going to work. So I agree with you.
I agree with you word by word that you're saying.
Gentlemen, I want to thank both of you for sharing so much time with us here on the program. And if you guys ever find your way out here in California, we'd love to have you guys in studio to continue this conversation. I think it's important. It's vital. It's something that we have to talk about. And hopefully through the conversations, maybe we come up with some solutions. It's like you were saying, Julian, get some think tanks going and start to solve some of these problems that we're dealing with.
Richard, thank you very much for having us.
Thank you for inviting us.
I have one final question for both of you, and I'm going to ping-pong it back and forth as we do three final questions, as I do for all of my guests. And so each of you will have an opportunity to think about your answer as the other is answering. Julian, the first question is for you.
Yes.
Who is Julian Hyman?
Julian Hyman is just another plain human being amongst the billions that have been born on this earth and will live a short life as we are all built to do. That's what who Julian Hyman is.
And Steve, who is Steve Hyman?
Someone who wants to see people and future generations happier than they are now.
All right. And Steve, what is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
I want to see basically open lines of communication with people around the world. It's possible. We have the internet. We have the means to do it. And if we can do it, we can solve a lot more problems.
Julian, what is it that you want to or hope to achieve through the work that you're doing now?
My effort is to bring civilization up to a better point and move out from the jungle into where we can control our short lives on Earth.
And finally, Julian, what is your life's purpose?
My life's purpose is I am a ring in a chain of humanity that we hope will go on for thousands of years, and I want to do the best I can to make that chain useful, that my link useful to that chain.
And Steve, what is your life's purpose?
To try, basically, to make humanity survive.
Well, I applaud the both of you, because what you're talking about is what we're talking about. I want us to move from survival mode, here's a word I've coined, to thrival mode. We shouldn't be struggling like this after being on the planet for I don't know how many thousands of years we've been here, and through the Industrial Revolution and all of the different technological advances, we shouldn't be struggling like this in this day and age. It just doesn't make a lot of sense. So, but your book, You Can Save Our World by Julian Hyman, is, I think, a good place to start. And both of you, thank you again for joining us on the program.
Thank you again.
Thank you, Richard. Thanks again for having us both.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love, Talal.